We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate. I'm Patricia Karpus, your host, along with my co-host every other week, Muse co-founder, Ariel Garten. We just launched a new Muse called Muse S, which features a comfortable, soft fabric headband. It gives you real-time feedback on your brain, heart, breath, and body during meditation, and also includes new features designed to help lull you to sleep. Check it out at choosemuse.com and use Untangle15 for your discount code. And if you've ever wanted to learn to meditate in a beautiful setting, check out the Do Nothing Leadership Retreat at donothingbook.com. It's 5 days in the Colorado Mountains starting April 19th and is focused on learning to meditate so that you can be a better leader at work and at home. It's a great place to chill and learn. Former Untangle guest Rob Dubay is the founder, and the reviews have been great. I'll be there this year leading the kickoff night, so I'd love to see you there. Now, on to the show.
So my amazing guest today is Dr. Rick Doblin. You are all in for an amazing treat. Rick is the founder of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and he is really the guy who's making all of the psychedelic studies that you may have been hearing about happen. He's a Harvard PhD in public policy, and he's here today to help us understand the value of legalizing psychedelics, what one might gain from them therapeutically, and what they can teach us about the mind and how it works. So welcome, Rick.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'll just say that you were a bit overgenerous in saying that I'm responsible for all the psychedelic research that's happening. I'm just responsible for a portion of it.
You've been an advocate in this space for a long time.
That's for sure. Yes, very sure.
Since what, 1984? That's when MAPS was formed, around then?
MAPS was in 86, but I started a nonprofit in 84 before MAPS that was gathering the psychedelic therapy community together to defend MDMA once the DEA moved to criminalize it, which they did in 84. But it was really in 72, when I was 18 years old, that I decided to devote my life to becoming a psychedelic therapist and helping bring back psychedelic research. And of course, going through my own psychedelic therapy as well.
So explain for the audience what the value of psychedelics is. Why are people so excited about it now? Why is it coming to the forefront of our consciousness and conversations around shifting your mind state in positive ways?
There's a Dr. Stanislav Grof, who's a Czech psychiatrist who lives in the United States now and in Germany, but he said something that helps explain the value of psychedelics. He said that psychedelics are to the study of the mind what the telescope is to astronomy and the microscope is to biology. And what he meant by that is that psychedelic is a word itself that means mind manifesting. And so psychedelic drugs are those drugs, some thousands of years old, some more modern, like LSD invented in 1938, but really discovered in 43, that bring material to the surface. That if you could say that we all have a psychedelic experience every night when we dream, that there's a little bit of a barrier between the conscious and the unconscious mind, and that barrier is made more permeable when we're dreaming. And psychedelics do something very similar. They bring emotions, thoughts, feelings, body sensations to the surface, both things that have been repressed, too difficult, or also things that we've never quite yet experienced. Both, you could say, therapeutic, transpersonal, mystical, spiritual. What we're talking about now in terms of medical applications is psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. So we're doing work with MDMA. Other groups are doing work with psilocybin. We're trying to do work with ibogaine. But you could just think about all the things that psychotherapy is good for, and psychedelics assist psychotherapy. So that helps explain why there's an enormously wide range of applications. And that's just for people that have a diagnosable disorder. There's also an enormous number of other applications for us, sort of otherwise healthy people, deepened people's meditation states, actually. So there's been incredible studies with lifelong Zen meditators who've gone to the University of Zurich for brain scans before and after going to a meditation retreat, and during which they get either a psilocybin or a placebo, and then they get studied afterwards, and they've said it helps deepen their meditation practice. Psychedelics can give us these mystical unitive experiences that have an incredible therapeutic and transformative potential. So there's an enormous wide range of applications.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you started in this field? You hinted at it, but it's quite a fascinating story.
I started really at age 18. I grew up in the 60s and believed all the propaganda about how if you took LSD more than 6 or 7 times, you were certifiably insane, that it would damage your chromosomes and you'd never have healthy babies, that it was just things that were hallucinations that gave you delusions, that there was nothing valuable to it. That was the background that I grew up in. And I really believed it up until the time that I was 17. But what was also going on in me was this slowly dawning recognition that humanity as a whole, and many of us as individuals, were dangerously unbalanced, that we were more developed intellectually and underdeveloped emotionally and spiritually. And as a result of our sort of primitive nature, we were prone to genocide, racism, mass murder, as a species destroying the environment. And so as a young boy, I was from a Jewish family and raised with stories of the Holocaust.
Yep, me too.
Yeah, and when you try to wrestle with that, it's just like, how could that be? How could people do that to other people? And it just points you to mental illness of a certain way, or how we process emotions, that the irrational can take such a dominance over the rational mind, and we could be saying and being led to believe things that are just patently absurd. And then we could even go beyond that into mass murder and cruelty. You could still fall prey to this kind of human mental illness writ large. And that just got me thinking more and more about psychology. And then as a young boy in school during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was another big wake-up call where you're taught to duck and cover. Students these days have active shooter drills. That's terrifying to think that somebody might come into your school and shoot it up and kill you. But it's in some ways another level of terror to think that there could be a nuclear war and that you could end up being incinerated with hundreds of millions, tens of millions of other people. So that also made me think it's now, even though World War II was over, it's not just the Germans, now it's the US and the Russians. And then the final step for me was the Vietnam War and growing up and near the last years of the lottery and being subject to that. And so now then that was finally that it was my own government. It wasn't the other doing things. And so all of that just really led me to despair about humans and to think that the deeper threats that we faced required something different than what we had available to us. And so when I was blessed to have very supportive, loving parents, and I felt like I was kind of a multi-generational situation where I had relatives in the 1880s and the early 20th century, actually, that came to the U.S. as immigrants. And then they managed to have the American dream and made a good living. And they sort of helped me to realize that I could work on deeper threats that would challenge us. So that led me to, again, think more and more about psychology and how do we grapple with our willingness, our inability to be empathic, our willingness to sort of define others as the enemy. And so that just really led me, as I said, to psychology. And what happened was I was studying the other. I was studying Russian. And in my Russian class, a friend of mine gave me a book to read, which I loved. I read this great book and I gave it back to him. And he said, "Do you realize that this author wrote some of this book under the influence of LSD?" And I was like, "That's impossible." nothing good comes out of LSD. It's all a delusion. The book was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey.
Yep.
And that's what really started challenging my propaganda that I had bought into. And so I thought if somebody could produce such an incredible piece of literature that really described a lot of what I felt about the world, that maybe there was more to this LSD than I realized. And it was then taking LSD during my first year in college that started opening my eyes. It helped me first off feel. I was very separated from my emotions, and the LSD brought feelings to the surface, but they weren't really feelings that I could handle very well. And I had the delusion that the more drugs you take, the faster you evolve. And, you know, if only that were true.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it just led me to being very unbalanced. And I completely didn't understand the importance of integration, the importance of taking time with what happens. And so I went to the guidance counselor at my college, and this was now 1972. And this was a different era. It was New College of Florida. It was a private college. It had started in the 1960s, an experimental school with no grades, with written evaluations. Everybody had to do a senior thesis with a lot of independent study. And I went to the guidance counselor and I said, I need help with my LSD trips. And this fellow took me seriously. And he gave me yet another book to read. And that book changed everything for me. And that was Realms of the Human Unconscious by Stan Grof. About the subtitle was Observations from LSD Research. And so reading that, it was this combination of science, because I didn't trust religion or mythology or certain kinds of cultural shared beliefs, but science I trusted.
Which become very difficult to trust when you're a child of the Holocaust and they were the reason that your family was threatened.
Yeah. But this was science, but it was looking at spirituality and these kind of mystical experiences, as well as a whole range of other kinds of experiences. And it seemed like these experiences of unity that you can have, not just with psychedelics, with meditation, with other forms. Many people have them spontaneously. It's gratuitous grace, sometimes it's called. But that felt to me like the antidote to division, to dehumanizing the other, dehumanizing nature, that if you felt that we're all wrapped up in something together, that we're all part of one thing, and if that went deeper than your nation or your culture or your religion or your race or your gender or any of the other ways that we divide ourselves, that would provide a base for tolerance and understanding. So it was really this kind of political understanding that led me to psychedelics. And then what was so important to me about Stan Grof's work and the Realms of the Human Unconscious and the description of the work that he did was that it had a reality check to it, which was therapy. Can we use this understanding of the mind? Can we use these tools to help people actually feel better, to work through problems, to work through anxiety, depression, alcoholism, heroin addiction, drug addiction? Can we actually test these theories on the level of, are we helping people lead a fuller life? And once I read this, it just everything, as I said, fell into place. But I also became aware that I was reading it a little bit too late, right after the backlash, after this research was being shut down, after the psychedelic 60s, Nixon had been reelected. This was the sort of the counterculture had crashed and burned. And Nixon had said that Leary was the most dangerous man in America. And that led me think, what is Tim Leary doing right? That Nixon would say that. And so all of this made me think, out of desperation, really, to the futility of human struggle. And at the same time, I was a draft resister for Vietnam.
Wow.
And was anticipating going to jail. I'd studied a lot of nonviolent resistance, Tolstoy and Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Thoreau and Emerson. And what I realized from that kind of literature was that it's important to confront things that you think are wrong, but that a lot of times you're sort of duped into participating at some point. And so the theory that I developed, actually there's an incredible quote from Martin Luther King, which says that the person that breaks the law and willingly suffers the consequences to show others the injustice of the law actually has the highest regard for the law. So it's actually a beautiful thought. And so that led me to realize that as far as it went to Vietnam, the very first step where a boy is induced sort of to cooperate is to register for the draft. And so I thought I would just not register for the draft. And that would mean that the system would have to come get me and expend the most energy and then put me in jail. And my parents were like sympathetic, but they said, you're never going to be able to be a doctor or lawyer, whatever. My dad was a doctor, that you'll be a felon. And so you'll have to figure out something else to do with your life. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll just have to figure out something else to do with my life. And what I didn't realize is that the system is incredibly inefficient. So even though that I had a Social Security number, I was paying taxes, the school, obviously, my high school obviously had my birth date and everything, nothing ever happened.
They never found you.
No. And it later turned out that 60,000 people or so never registered for the draft. And enough people were walking into the draft board to keep the war machine going. Once I read Stan's book, and I thought, wow, I could be a psychedelic therapist. I could be an underground psychedelic therapist. There's no license for that.
They can't revoke your license for being a criminal. Yep, there's just no license.
Yeah, so I thought, okay, this is my new strategy. So at 18, I thought, okay, underground psychedelic therapy, I need it myself. I can learn to provide it to others. And then as it turned out, years later, the very first day that President Carter assumed the presidency, he pardoned all the draft resistors. And that made me start again thinking, oh, maybe I can have above ground career because I was no longer a criminal and I'd never even been arrested or anything for being a draft resistor. So I found this loophole and I just kept thinking, yeah, this is what I want to do. But I felt really unbalanced and I felt I had to get more balanced before I could put psychedelics directly. And so I didn't have Muse or other tools available for integrating through meditation or other things. I did with some friends of mine build flotation tanks and try to, like following John Lilly, and did LSD in isolation environments and did various things. But basically, I spent a decade trying to get integrated, trying to get balanced, dropped out of college in the middle of my freshman year, and then 10 years later, went back to college. And that's at the same place, New College, that I had started. And during my first semester at college, there was a workshop that Stan Grof was giving with his wife, Christina, at Esalen called The Mystical Quest. And I realized that the school was excellent in off-campus study. So I got a professor who said that he would be willing to give me credit for going off to Esalen. And so I spent a month.
What a dream.
It was incredible to plan a curriculum, a four-year curriculum to become a psychedelic therapist. And while I was there that very first month, this woman, Debbie Harlow, who wasn't in the workshop, but came by Esalen, and she said, there's a new drug out there, and it's called Atom, and it helps you to feel love. It helps you speak to people. It helps you be a better listener. It helps you speak from your heart. It's an incredible experience. But I really didn't understand it. I thought, you know, I feel love already. I'm in love. I feel like I'm a good listener. I say what I think. And so I undervalued the drug. I saw a group of people sitting around in a circle doing MDMA, also known as Atom at the time. And I was just like, how profound this can be. If you take a drug like LSD, you can't talk if you take enough of it. But if you can talk and be verbal, you know, it just can't be mystical. It can't be that profound. So I underestimated it. But I like to say I was foolish enough to underestimate it, but smart enough to buy some.
And many young people have underestimated the power of love.
Yeah. And when I took that drug with my girlfriend, I was just shocked how deep and profound it was and how subtle a shift it was from normal consciousness, so that it is easier to integrate lessons from MDMA than I would say from psilocybin or LSD or the classic psychedelics. And it was at the same time that it was Atom, this sort of therapy drug, it was also just starting to be sold as ecstasy in public settings. So it was clear that it was doomed. And I thought, I learned about LSD after the backlash. And now I'm learning about MDMA before the backlash so that I can get involved to try to protect it and to keep it around. So that's what really got me more involved politically.
That's amazing. And what a history of drug experiences in America, from hippies through the backlash and to MDMA going into the 90s raves, but in the 80s, that kind of dance culture and that kind of popular culture. And you were really around to witness it from the inside.
Well, I'm so lucky that I was able to know about it when it was legal. So in 1983, and this maybe will get directly relating to meditation. In 1983, I read this book. So 82 is when I discovered MAP, MDMA. In 83, I read a book, New Genesis, Shaping a Global Spirituality by Robert Mueller, who was the Assistant Secretary General of the UN, different Robert Mueller than we know of. And it was an incredible book. And what he basically said is that we have the United Nations to mediate conflicts between countries, but a lot of those conflicts are actually religious-based. And so we need to move away from fundamentalism and to see religions kind of like languages, that they're different takes, different approaches, but they're all about communicating the same essential thing. And that if we could have this global spirituality, he had a picture of the earth from space on the book, that that would be the way that humanity needs to move forward and can overcome a lot of these conflicts. And it was a very inspiring book, but it didn't say anything about psychedelics. So I decided I would write him a letter and say that I completely appreciated his book, but he missed psychedelics, and psychedelics can teach us about this mystical experience. And whether you say it's pseudo-mystical or real mystical, either way, they're educational tools. And since every new way of killing gets unlimited money from the militaries around the world to try to figure out how to use these new technologies for destructive potentials, that if psychedelics could help us understand spirituality, that it was important, essential actually, that we study that. And I asked him, would you help bring back psychedelic research? And to my utter astonishment, he wrote me back. And he said, I understood his book. He did believe that it was important to do psychedelic research, and he would help me try to bring back psychedelic research. And he gave me a list of mystics to write to. And of course, I read between the lines, and I heard him say, send them MDMA. And one of them was Brother David Steindl-Rast, who's a Christian mystic, who's just in his 90s right now, amazing. Rabbi Zalman Schachter,
yeah.
Wayne Teasdale, Vanya Palmer is from Switzerland, who did the experiment that I just described all these years later with meditators, Zen meditators taking psilocybin during meditation retreat. And so what these various people would do would be to use MDMA and then report back to Robert Mueller what their experiences were. And Brother David used half doses of MDMA in the monastery for meditation and felt that it was a tool to deepen their meditation practice. So again, it's like not that you do it all the time. I'm not trying to say that you meditate under the influence of MDMA on a frequent basis, but just if you can have a deeper experience of meditation, this drug MDMA can quiet the mind in a way that you can experience sometimes deeper states of meditation. And then on your own, afterwards, you can use that as kind of a signpost or a goal, and you can eventually develop the capacity to do it without the drug.
It's amazing. So it gives you a sense of where you're going. Yeah, I got to this place once, so I know that place is possible. And I know it's a place I could potentially find inside myself later.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's one metaphor, sort of like you're wandering lost through a forest and you climb up at the top of a tree, and then you get the vista of where you need to go, but you still need to climb down the tree and walk there through the forest. So once you can orient where you want to go, then you can kind of do the work to integrate it. And I think that's what we're finding, is that these experiences can be inspirational and offer guidance, but that they're not in and of themselves enough. There has to be this real emphasis on the integration process.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
What are some of the ways that you suggest the integration happens? How do you take that knowledge within your body and then learn from it and shift through it?
Well, I think a lot of it is practice, and practice without the drug. So it's to really understand that these are human capabilities that we can learn how to experience on our own. I mean, it's hard for somebody to say, oh, I'm going to imagine myself tripping on LSD. Those are highly refined skills.
If you don't know what it's like, you can never get there yourself yet. It's hard to imagine what you don't know, what you've never seen.
Yeah. But I think one of the ways about integrating is to process the emotions. in psychotherapy, it's really, well, to give you an example. So MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD is basically a 3.5 month process. We have to standardize it for research. And so there's 3 MDMA experiences, 1 month apart, and there's 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions roughly on a weekly basis, 3 before the first MDMA experience for preparation, and then 3 sessions after each MDMA experience for integration. And so what the integration process means is that you take the feelings and the thoughts and the memories that have come to you during the MDMA experience, and you reflect on it, and you integrate. If you had something like, oh, I'm a little bit too angry sometimes, like for PTSD patients, that often they battle with rage, and they can understand where this rage is coming from. Then when they have this feelings of the rage starting again, that they take a deep breath or they take a bit of time out and they try to process it without being so quickly reactive. So that's a good way to describe, I think, this integration process, is you have a feeling or an intuition that you know something that you're doing is hitting you in the wrong direction, but that you don't automatically go there. You sit with it. And what we're helping people to do is to have a comfort level, you could say, with higher levels of anxiety. So instead of launching into some behaviors that are designed to minimize the anxiety, you sit with it. You can handle greater levels of anxiety, and then you can make a more rational choice about acting in a different way. And you just have to repeat that over and over and over. And so I'd say integration is about practice. It's about really trying to not see the drug experience as an end in itself. I think that's a good distinction between recreational use of these drugs and therapeutic or spiritual use of these drugs, where recreational use of these drugs, you're going off to have an experience, and that's it. That's the end in and of itself. You're taking this drug to have an experience, and once it's over, it's over. But for a therapy or spirituality or for meditation, you have these experiences, and then you try to do them on your own without the drugs, and you sort of exercise your potential to move in that direction. And that's really the hard work. Houston Smith, one of the experts of world religion, said there's a difference between a mystical experience, between a spiritual experience and a spiritual life. And the difference is integration, is putting it into practice. And what I found from my early experiences when I was 18, that delusion that the more experiences you have with psychedelics, the faster you evolve. It's totally not that way at all. And in fact, sometimes you can get into this cycle where the more you do, it keeps you from evolving because you're running away from the integration.
And that's actually specifically what drug addiction is. When you want to find a place to escape and the drugs give you an experience to do that, when you come off the drugs, you unfortunately don't integrate effectively. And so you want more drugs to take you away from your experience of reality. And so in a sense, this therapeutic approach of integration is the antidote to addiction.
Very much so. I think the fundamental thing that we need to realize about psychedelic drugs is that they're just tools. They're not inherently therapeutic or inherently spiritual in and of themselves. It's how they're used. To give a good example about that, this is about 10 years ago, but within 1 week, 2 women contacted us with a similar kind of a story, but with different outcomes. They both said that they had taken MDMA at a rave and had remembered prior sexual abuse and rape. And one of them said that she was with a bunch of friends. They were out there for recreational experience. And they didn't want to talk about what was this more serious thing that she had to talk about. And so she tried to stuff her feelings down. And as a result, she ended up feeling worse for months afterwards. And she called us months afterwards and saying this wasn't helpful. And then that same week, this other woman said, similar story, but I was with a girlfriend and we went off into the corner and talked about my memories that had come up of this rape. And we were able to work through it and process a lot of the emotions, and now I feel better. So that really emphasizes this idea that these are just tools. They're not inherently therapeutic. And so I avoid the use of the word entheogen, which is a new word sort of to talk about these psychedelic drugs, which is to reveal the God within. It's kind of overly positive because it doesn't always do that. And hallucinogen I also avoid because that's overly negative. That's like it's all a delusion. Psychedelic means mind manifesting. It just means it brings things to the surface. It's a more neutral word. It's culturally loaded, but I think we've done a good job as a culture over the last 50 years to remove it from the symbol of cultural rebellion and counterculture and turn on, tune in, drop out. Now I think that it's for most people's minds, the word psychedelic has a much more exciting, interesting connotation rather than a symbol of rebellion.
Particularly when you pair it with the idea of therapy, when you call it psychedelic assisted therapy or psychedelic therapy, you bring in the context of the work that is really being done from it, the examination that goes on from what you bring up inside. I have a friend or two who's being trained to become a psychedelic assisted therapist.
Great.
I used to work as a therapist myself. I probably won't go into the psychedelic space because I'm firmly here in the meditation space and have much that I'm doing now. But I've learned about some of the methodologies that are used. And it's a really beautiful way to help somebody through seeing through a new lens.
Yeah, although I would say that one of the most exciting things for me is to see how the meditation space and the psychedelic space are coming together. And that not again in this constant use of psychedelics, but just in this occasional use and then using meditation as a tool for integration, which then both enhances the therapy and emotion, but also can deepen the meditation practice. So a lot of the situation, I just returned from Hawaii for the memorial service for Ram Dass. And he was such an inspiration to so many of us. But I think a lot of people misinterpret his message, which was, his message was not, oh, I did psychedelics and then I went to India and found my guru and now it's all about meditation. He was still very interested in what the potential of psychedelics were. And I think what we're seeing is that the mindfulness and meditation has become so accepted, so mainstream, which has taken roughly 50 years for that to happen, that now there's a comfort level in the community to explore the occasional use of psychedelics in a synergistic relationship with meditation.
Both meditation and psychedelics are a lens through which to understand consciousness and a lens through which to observe, learn about the self, and then potentially either accept or shift one's behavior depending on what you've discovered.
Yeah, there's a great book, if people are interested, called Zigzag Zen. Alan Bedina, a friend of mine who wrote it, and it's just about the linkages between Zen meditation and psychedelics.
Let's move for a second to the work that's actually happening, because people may not know that there are real clinics right now who are using psychedelic assisted therapies. Can you talk about a little bit what's happening on the ground and the trials that you're doing with the FDA?
Right now, there's well over 100 clinics where people are using ketamine for depression. And one of the isomers of ketamine, molecules are racemic, they're sort of left-handed, right-hand mirror images, and you can separate the molecules. And so one of the halves of ketamine, and they're not equivalent halves because they're their mirror image, but they shape differently, so they interact in the brain differently. And so S-ketamine has been made into a medicine for depression, and it's considered to be the most important discovery in the treatment of depression in many, many, many decades, with a new novel mechanism of action that works more quickly. But the problem there with ketamine is that it has been developed by a for-profit pharmaceutical company that was working to maximize profits, not maximize patient outcomes. And so S-ketamine can work by itself to help people get out of depression. But if you were to combine it with psychotherapy, it would be more effective and you'd end up needing less ketamine. But that has sort of opened up the field of psychiatry, this idea that this new discovery of this drug. Now, ketamine is called a dissociative anesthetic, and it's used in anesthesia, but roughly 1/10 the anesthetic dose is the psychedelic dose, or the dose for treating people with depression. That's sort of the beginning of these psychedelic clinics with the first sort of legal drug for a treatment of depression. But what we're seeing right now is more studies with MDMA and also with psilocybin. So we're focusing MAPS, so MAPS.org for those people that want more information. We're focusing on MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. We've also done studies with autistic adults with social anxiety, focusing on social anxiety, life-threatening illnesses, people who are scared of death. There's been a study in England that we didn't fund, but others did. We trained the people and supplied MDMA with MDMA for alcoholism, because trauma is often what drives drug abuse. So we're now started MAPS in 86. It took us till 92 to get permission for the first safety study. That was through the 90s. Then from 2000 to 2016, we did what are called phase two studies, where you basically are trying to figure out how to do phase three studies. Phase three are the large scale randomized controlled placebo-controlled double-blind studies that you need to do to prove safety and efficacy to get permission for marketing. So we are now in the midst of phase three studies.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's roughly a $55 or so million experiment that we're engaged in now. All the funds are coming through donations and not through investors. So we're doing nonprofit drug development. And the moment of truth for us coming up is going to be in the next couple months when we have what's called the interim analysis, where we get to look at a unblinded data monitoring committee. We'll look at the data and let us know if we're on track for statistical significance in the first of two phase three studies. So that's going to be a really exciting point. We're kind of hopeful, but the study is blinded, so we don't know yet what the answer will be, but that'll be our moment of truth. And if it goes well, as we think it will, then by the middle to end of 2021, we should have the data that we need to submit to FDA. And by sometime in 2022, we're hoping for FDA approval for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. And the FDA has declared MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD a breakthrough therapy, meaning that it's among the most important drugs being studied. Yes. So the pharma, two-thirds of the applications from pharma for breakthrough therapy designation are rejected. And so not only do we have that, though, but there's other groups, one called Compass, which is a for-profit company that's working with psilocybin, another called USONA, which is a nonprofit working with psilocybin. And both of them have obtained breakthrough therapy designation for psilocybin for depression. Compass was for treatment-resistant depression and USONA for major depressive disorder. And so they're in phase two studies now, both in the U.S. and in Europe, trying to figure out and gather all the data that they need to move to phase three. So we anticipate by 2023 or so, 2024, possibly even the end of 2022, that there should be a very good chance that FDA will approve psilocybin. The important thing, again, it's psilocybin or MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And so the policy aspects of this is that the FDA has the ability to customize policies and regulations for particular drugs, for the risks of particular drugs. And so since we're saying that both MDMA and psilocybin is really psychotherapy assisted by the drugs, the only people that will be able to prescribe and treat patients are people that have been through the training programs that understand the therapy. And the drugs will only be medicines given under direct supervision of the therapists, which means that it will be in clinic settings.
And hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
These clinics will eventually be hundreds and thousands and eventually 10,000 or so psychedelic clinics. And the therapists, and this is probably true of your friends that are interested in being psychedelic therapists, they're not interested in just being, I want to be an MDMA therapist because it's the best drug, or I want to be a psilocybin therapist because it's the best drug, or I want to be a ketamine therapist. They want to be cross-trained in all the different drugs in the new emerging field of psychedelic medicine, of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. So the clinics will be a place where people can go and they'll discuss with their therapists which is the right drug at the right moment for the people to take. And they may start by a couple MDMA experiences because it's the most gentle of the psychedelics. Then they may move to psilocybin. Eventually, they may move to LSD, or they might have a ketamine experience. So I think that these clinic settings will start with the patients. And we're already making some moves where the family members can end up getting treated as well, even if you don't have the diagnosis. So we did one study with a woman, Candace Monson. It was called Cognitive Behavioral Conjoint Therapy. Conjoint means couples or dyads, where one person has PTSD, but it affects the relationship. And we bring both people into the clinic and they both get MDMA. There's a study that we're trying to work on with some researchers now that's going to be cancer patients. Many of them have PTSD from all the medical procedures. So it'll be a cancer patient with PTSD and one of their family members, and then they'll both get MDMA. So these clinics will start with the patients, they'll expand to the family members, and then eventually, when our society wises up, and I think this will be 2035 or so, when we end up recognizing that the whole system of prohibition has been counterproductive, it hasn't achieved reductions in drug abuse or has an increased safety, that we'll move to more of a licensed legalization system and people will be able to go to these clinics for initiation, for having these experiences under supervision. And then if they understand what they're getting into, then they get a license and they can go buy it on their own. And I think that we'll really try to get mass mental health as the goal of people having these experiences with proper, honest drug education about risks and benefits, with harm reduction methods, with pure drugs. And I think what'll happen is that the most difficult cases, the people with the deepest depressions or the deepest PTSD, will end up going to the clinics with the trained people, but we'll try to have lots and lots of people with peer support and preventative medicine, you could say.
It's amazing. So you've been working for almost 40 years for this.
Well, yeah, if you start with 72, and this is where I, you know, it's now 48 years. So what I'm feeling about after 50 years, I'm going to be able to start my real career as a psychedelic therapist.
You did all this just so that you could have a job that wasn't a doctor or a lawyer. And that moment is almost coming.
Right. And that wasn't illegal either. So yes, I will become a legal psychedelic therapist. That's my long-term goal. Yeah. And it will be for people who are for personal growth, for end of life, for vision quests earlier in life. What are people are going to do with their lives?
I want to return for a second to something that you said earlier, because you might have noticed it really touched a nerve with me. And that was that part of your culture growing up was being the child of the Holocaust and understanding just how difficult the world can be when people are at odds with one another, when you have fear and scarcity thinking. I too am very much, I'm the grandchild of Holocaust. Probably 75% of my family on one side died, 50% of my family on the other side. And my grandmother was a Holocaust speaker. So I very much grew up with this narrative and the importance of being able to find common ground with one another. And that's really what drove me into the work that I do now, helping people to understand what goes on inside their own mind and be able to quiet their drives. And I've always said, when the war inside our mind quiets, then the war outside can follow. And so it really is a mission to me to help people not be afraid of one another, to not want to, you know, with their own scarcity thinking and aggressions of protection, to be aggressors to one another, to instead find the commonality, the oneness, the ability to quiet your own mind and feel a sense of safety that allows you to move equitably through life and with others. And sort of when we look around at what's happening today in the United States and the rest of the world, and we're at a very fractured place again. And so I become very hopeful about ideas and technologies and solutions that may allow people to dismantle some of their own fear and interact more equitably and gregariously with one another.
That's a beautiful vision. Just to talk about MDMA, for example, it reduces activity in the amygdala, which is the fear processing part of the brain, so that you can, here's just one funny example. At Burning Man, this family came up to me, a mother and her son was early 20s, and they said that he had a video he wanted to show me. And he explained that he had been frightened of spiders, his whole life terrified of spiders. And he had taken MDMA outside one time and he happened to see a spider. And instead of immediately launching into the fear, because the MDMA quiets the amygdala, he was able to see the spider as this tiny little thing that he could squash, that he didn't need to be scared of the spider. The spider needed to be scared of him. And so he felt like, to prove to himself that he was over the fear of spiders, while he's on MDMA, he goes to a pet store and asks them to get out a non-poisonous tarantula, which they put on him, and it crawled all over him. And the videos of him with this tarantula, this kid that had previously been terrified of spiders. So it's amazing that there's been studies in octopuses by Johns Hopkins researchers, Goldolan, and she gave MDMA to octopuses and tried to see what they do. So 550 million years ago or so, humans and octopuses diverged, and octopuses have different kinds of brains than we do, and they're solitary creatures. They hang out by themselves. Rarely during mating season do they seek out other octopuses, but almost all the time they're by themselves. And when you put the octopuses in the various experimental contraptions, they don't hang out with other octopuses. But Gull found out a way to soak the octopus in water that had MDMA in it for 10 minutes. The octopus absorbs the MDMA. And then you put it in this experimental chamber and they'll spend way more time with other octopuses, whereas before they wouldn't. So this idea of quieting the fear part of the brain as a way to help people process these sort of instinctual ways that if you're different from me, I need to be scared of you. I think this idea of how do we help people get underneath these kind of cultural prejudices and feel how we're all woven together and that that's our primary base. And that's, I think, through this mystical experience. Psychedelics are one of the most reliable ways and have been used for thousands of years to help people have. And then the other is all the traumas that people have had. We're working with a woman, Rachel Yehuda, who's a psychotherapist, and she's an expert in multi-generational trauma and epigenetics and how she did studies with Holocaust survivors and their children and was even able to identify biologically ways in which the mothers can transmit trauma. And it's not just the mothers, it's the fathers as well, that you can encode on the sperm certain kinds of ways that...
ways that your cortisol spikes, ways that you react, parts of your DNA that activate in the face of trauma that will allow you to have a cortisol spike more quickly and longer because somehow that was productive for the parent. Yeah.
Yeah. So that I think we see the world through this lens of trauma a lot of times. With PTSD, what we've shown, or other people have really shown with brain scans, is that PTSD changes people's brains.
Yep.
You have more active amygdala, you have reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex, and you're not able to process things into long-term memory. And MDMA does the opposite. MDMA reduces activity in the amygdala, it increases activity in the prefrontal cortex, and it increases connectivity between the amygdala and the hippocampus so that you can end up taking these traumatic memories that are not really memories. They seem like they're happening all the time, where you're sort of stuck in this loop of the past. It's never quite passed with PTSD, and MDMA can help people process that and then put it into the past. And I think this link to the Holocaust that you talked about too, I was a little bit luckier in that one side of my family left Europe and Russia in 1880. So a lot of the people that were killed, I didn't know. And my grandfather on my father's side came over in 1920 from Poland. And so bunches of his relatives were killed, but I didn't have a direct survivor of the Holocaust as you did, which would be just horrifying to have somebody have to go through that.
All four of my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. I only knew three of them. My mother's father died before I was born, but the other three, I was alive with them till I was in my 30s. They all lived very long lives into their 90s. And from all three of them, I would hear the stories. And so my grandmother was literally a Holocaust speaker. It was her mission to go to schools, rotary clubs, whoever would hire her for the day, and tell them about the atrocities that she experienced. She was saved by Raoul Wallenberg. So my grandfather was about to be shot into the Danube. She was in the Swedish safe house and was able to call him on the telegraph machine and say, come on over. There they are. And so he went down to the Danube and saved them. They were in Budapest, but like when all of the ghetto was about to be bombed, and somehow they were saved. So like my grandmother's immediate family was saved, but on my dad's side, a number of my grandparents' siblings died. And then just all of the other relatives, like you look at the family tree and it's astonishing. And so I so deeply grew up with this consciousness of the Holocaust. I actually consider myself to be a Holocaust speaker. When my grandmother passed away, it was like, okay, I've now picked up the mantle. I did a TED talk just before she died with her telling her story, my mom, who's an artist, talking about how the horror of the Holocaust to her in New York City turned into the beauty of being an artist. And then me, how the being driven against the scarcity thinking and against the fear of war caused me to go into meditation and build Muse and sort of imagine a different kind of a future.
Wow. And what did your grandparents, what did they think about solutions, or what did they think about meditation, for example?
Very into it. So my mom's mom was very sophisticated. She was the Budapest grandmother. You know, the Hungarians were very sophisticated. And so she was one who was the Holocaust speaker. And her approach was always to talk about heroism and how one person could make a difference. Since she was directly saved by Raoul Wallenberg, the idea that one person could buck against the trend and be heroic, that you could stand up in the face of danger and fear and say, no, this is not right. That was the message that she would always give to schools. And she would say, you know, whatever it is, if somebody's thirsty and they need a glass of water, one person can make a difference. On the other side of the family, the Polish side, they were like very provincial. They came from tiny, tiny little towns in Poland. They didn't really ever want to talk about their experience except when we pressed them. When my father married a Hungarian from New York, they thought that she was a witch and had put a spell over him. Like they're small-minded. So it wasn't something that they ever understood. But I have this amazing photo that my mom just sent me of my grandmother before she died using an early version of the Muse. Because to her, I was like the future. I was like the thing that was going to, you know, save us in some way. Like this, she'd always call me in my future. And so she believed deeply in it.
I just should say that I think the reason that I was able to grapple with the Holocaust is that I grew up in such a loving family with such support and in such safety that I felt like I had the safety to think about these deeper threats. I really need to acknowledge my parents for letting me break all of their expectations of what they wanted for me. I dropped out of college at 18 and I said to them, I want to leave. I'm the oldest of four kids. And so I was the first one away from the nest. I'm supposed to be the example. And so I sort of crash and burn in my first year of college. And I'm like, I want to drop out of college. I want to study LSD and I want you guys to pay for it. And eventually, after a couple months, my parents agreed to do that. And that's what launched me on this thing. And I also think that I was born in the era of American exceptionalism.
Yes.
So I kind of absorbed that we're somehow Americans. We rule the world. We're like better than somehow we're exceptional. And then I was a male. I was the firstborn male child. And then I'm white. And then my family was well off. So I had all of these kind of things going for me that protected me and that gave me the space to really look at the cruelty and try to understand how do we respond to it.
Well, thank you, Mommy and Daddy Doblin.
Yeah.
For your love and support. And thank you, Rick, for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Ryle. Thank you. Because right now, I think this public education is actually the crucial phase we're in, because we are nearing, in a couple of years, we hope to have approval by the FDA for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. The psilocybin people are moving in that direction. And we really need to avoid another backlash, because I think we're in more critical times than we've ever been as a species, with the load that we're placing on the planet, with the incredibly destructive technologies that we have. I just think it's very crucial times, and we really need to find a way to harness these destructive energies and transform them. And so we have the permission for the research. The culture is opening to psychedelics, but it's really now coming down to public education, like this podcast, which I was so glad to do that with you, just help people understand what's going on, and hopefully not be so frightened by it, but be excited about it.
Thank you. Well, what you shared is certainly exciting, and the possibility to understand one's minds in meaningful and safe ways is always compelling. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
If people want to learn more, which I'm sure lots of people do, where can they go and how can they support your work?
Yeah. MAPS.org is our website. There's an enormous amount of information there. We are actually in the early 1990s, around 93, 94, I was contacted by this fella, and he said that he had a tragedy in his life, that his son was killed in a motorcycle accident. And the only thing that helped him and his wife cope with it was MDMA. And he wanted to pay back, and he said he wanted to donate a website. And I said, what's a website? So we are in the first 1,000 websites in the whole world. And so there's an enormous amount of information on the website. So you can just go to maps.org. And we're doing nonprofit pharmaceutical drug development. We want to demonstrate that not only a new approach to healing, but a new approach to marketing drugs. And so MAPS is the nonprofit. We've created the MAPS Public Benefit Corp, which is a for-profit to market MDMA. And so we'll be able to market it for reasonable profit. But the nonprofit owns 100% of the for-profit, because selling MDMA for profit is something that should be taxable. And so that's our kind of virtuous circle. The for-profit is the one that does the research and will eventually market MDMA. And the nonprofit is what people donate to and what owns the for-profit. And so I think people can help by donations, become a MAPS member. There's all sorts of books that people could get from our bookstore. And the other thing that we're doing is global psychedelic dinners. So I think one of the ways that people can help out is you look at other social change movements, in particular gay rights, and how did they make so much progress? And it was because people were hidden, who were homosexual or gay. They didn't feel comfortable sharing it. There's all sorts of people that were gay that we never knew about. So it was the coming out, the people that felt comfortable to do that. And then you realize that's somebody that I know. I don't need to be scared of them. I don't need to hate them. They're sharing who they are. And we need a coming out like that for psychedelics as well. That's, I think, what's happening more and more. And so these global psychedelic dinners, and there's information on the website about that, is basically people just invite a bunch of people for dinner and then tell stories about your psychedelic experiences. And it can be good experiences, bad experiences, anything like that. But it's this sort of to facilitate this sort of coming out process. And you could use the dinners to raise money and donate to MAPS or donate to any kind of other charity or build a local psychedelic society. But I think that's really one of the best ways for people to help, because it doesn't take money. You just make a bunch of spaghetti and you invite some people and you practice this sort of coming out process.
So if you're interested in finding a global psychedelic dinner, you can go to maps.org. Thank you. This was such an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and for your work, Rick.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity.
That was Dr. Rick Doblin, the founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. You can find out more at maps.org. And I actually did a TED Talk with my grandmother, the Hungarian Holocaust survivor and speaker, and my mother, New York artist, and myself. And if you're curious, you can check it out in our show notes. I've resurrected the link. So until next week, keep your hearts and your minds open. And Patricia will be back with more Untangled.